wanted to submit, to lie on my back and take whatever he was willing to give me. I wanted to, but I couldn't. Arriving at the hotel, I shuffled toward Wayne's bus. A member of his crew saw me and assumed I was coming to see Wayne, which I was, but not before I stopped in to talk to Shad. "Hey, Corinne, you coming?" the entourage member said as he held the door to Wayne's bus open for me. "Yeah, in a second, but I have to see Bao first." He seemed shocked as I knocked on the door of Bao's bus. Once inside, I headed straight to the back where Shad was playing video games with his buddies. "I just wanted to tell you, I'm headed over to Wayne's bus." Shad looked up at me. "All right, that's cool. Does he know you're going over there?"
"Yeah, he asked me to come see him."
"Okay, well, I'll be here when you're done."
"Awesome, be back in a few minutes." I turned and ran out of Shad's bus and toward Wayne's, just a few feet away. I knocked on the door and was let aboard by the same entourage member from earlier, who then exited as I walked in.
"Hey," Wayne said, coming out of the back room to greet me.
"Hey," I returned, before falling into his arms. I held on to Wayne and felt his heartbeat against mine, ran my hand across the bullet wound scar on his back and breathed in the scent of his dreadlocked hair, as I'd done every time I saw him. Everything felt so right, yet so wrong. He was having a baby with another woman, and I was seeing his friend. Everything was fucked. He began to kiss my neck and ran his right hand up my skirt. I shivered and cried. Then I backed away from Wayne, tears in my eyes, and said, "I can't do this anymore."
"What do you mean?"
"You left me. Now I'm leaving you."
That said, I walked toward the exit.
"You're not gonna really leave, are you?"
I opened the door, the alarm sounded, and I ran back to Shad's bus. That was it. Wayne and I were over. Chapter 9, Fear and Loathing. Shad and I continued to see each other through the fall and into early 2009. As the months rolled on, the heat in our relationship cooled, and he became less available to me, the same as Wayne had before. I would call and text often with no response, and gone were the times when we'd spend hours video chatting. Shad was slipping away from me as our relationship ran its course, and with Wayne gone, I was getting lonely. Still, over the past 7 months, I had been enjoying my freedom and my life without Aaron. It was Shad who got me eating again, and it didn't take long for me to regain all the weight I lost while with Aaron. I felt gorgeous and sexy. I felt wanted and cared for when I was with Shad, and my confidence was reestablished. I was more aware of my worth and my vitality than I had been in recent years. I felt empowered with Shad, just as I had with Wayne. The problem was, I never felt empowered on my own, and with Wayne gone and Shad on his way out, I found myself beginning to feel vulnerable again. It was early afternoon on June 2, 2009, when I left my perch on the hill and drove to the local donut shop. I was sad that day, not having heard from Shad in almost a week and regretting letting Wayne walk out of my life. I needed comfort food. So I pulled up to the donut shop located in a shopping center just minutes from my home and hopped out of my Range Rover in a white sweatsuit. My body stretched my sweatpants to the limit as I shuffled into the shop, unaware I was being watched. Moments later, with a dozen donuts in hand, I hopped into my SUV and made my way back home, content to spend the rest of the day in bed with my newly acquired confections. I undressed and wrapped my hair in a silk scarf, prepared to shove several donuts and beer claws down my throat and just lie there. But seconds after climbing under the covers with my pink box of sugary snacks, there was a heavy knock at the door. I jumped up, then paused. I was almost certain I'd closed the gate behind me after pulling into the garage and checked the alarm system to make sure it was engaged. My heart pounded as I slid out of bed and crept toward the front door, trying to avoid creaking floorboards. I poked my head around the corner, looking at the front door, which was made of heavily smoked glass. I could see an imposing figure standing there, tall and broad. Whoever he was, he would have had to jump my 6-foot spiked gate, if closed, to get to my front door. The thought bothered me, but I had a sneaking suspicion who it might be and called out to the alarming figure in my most menacing voice.
Who is it?
It's Aaron.
Who? I asked, unsure my hearing was correct.
Aaron.
Who? I asked again in a state of disbelief.
Aaron! Aaron!
Hold on! I commanded as I ripped the scarf from my head, brushed my hair, and slipped on my white sweatpants.
Coming!
I announced as I gathered my senses, my heart pounding in my chest, my pet pit bull, Jolie, scurrying to the front door. I took a deep breath, held Jolie by her collar, and opened the door to find Aaron standing there. 7 months after he ran over my foot with his car, 7 months after he took out a restraining order against me.
Hey, he said.
Hey.
How are you?
Perfect and gorgeous.
Yes, you are.
What are you doing here? I asked as I looked beyond the entranceway to the gate, seeing it was closed and his car parked along the curb. How did you get in here? You jumped the gate?
I did. I came to check on you.
I'm fine. I don't need to be checked up on.
Can I come in?
He asked as I held Jolie back from attacking him with her wet doggy kisses. Sure. As he walked into my home, he began to explain himself.
I was at the Verizon store getting a new phone, and I saw this woman hop out of a white Range Rover in these white sweatpants with a fat butt, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her. She went into the donut shop, and I watched as she ordered her donuts and walked out.
Oh, really? I asked with a smirk on my face.
Yeah. So I was thinking about running out to the parking lot and talking to her until I realized it was you. You gained your weight back. It looks good.
I know. Go on.
So when I realized it was you, I hesitated for a little bit. I got my new phone and I watched you drive away. I was going to just go about my business, but I couldn't let you get away from me. So I decided to follow you home and here I am.
It was amazing. It never fails, really. Every time you get past an ex, they miraculously pop back into your life at the precise moment you don't think you need them anymore. It's as if they have some sort of radar. Aaron was always good at this, at feeling out the exact moment when I might be on the mend and coming back into my life to finish me off. It was as if he was thinking, how dare she be okay without me? How dare she gain all her weight back and then some and be happy with some other man or men or even by herself? How dare she move on and get over me after all I've put her through? He hated to see me well. And our relationship from the very start was a game of seek and destroy, a sick version of Battleship in which I was the only blip on the sonar and I was the only one who stood to lose everything. Everything. But I was lonely. Wayne was gone and Shad was obviously no longer interested and I just didn't want to be alone. So I let Aaron back into my home and into my life. He said all the right things, everything I needed to hear. He made apologies and promises and admitted to his wrongdoings. He told me about a church he wanted us to join and how much Jonah missed Naeem and me. He talked about getting married, having children of our own, standing up to his mother and keeping our family together. Aaron tugged on every fucking heartstring I had, and I buckled under the weight of my hope. A month later, I called Shaw to tell him our relationship was over. I'm getting back with my ex, I said softly.
What? Get the fuck out of here. After all the shit he put you through, I sat here and watched you cry about all the shit he did to you, and you're going to go back to that motherfucker?
Well, you and I haven't been talking much. You don't even check for me like you used to, so I'm going back to where I belong.
Man, you don't belong with that man. I was just saying to myself I should call you and fly you out here to chill. I mean, I know we haven't been talking as much. I've been an asshole and I know it. But come on, Kay.
Shad warned me emphatically and tried to convince me to change my mind and hop on the next flight to Atlanta, if for no other reason than to save me from myself and from the man who'd done nothing but torture and abuse me. But I'd already let Aaron back in, and as he stood there listening to Shad scream at me through the speakerphone, he smirked, knowing he had me back in his grips. All it had taken was talk of being better than before, and cleverly placed promises to make our family official by getting married, exactly what I'd wanted to hear my entire adult life. From then forward, I became obsessed with the thought of it all. Aaron knew my voids and continued to dangle emotional carrots, and I continued to chase them around and around again and again. We spent the first 30 days after he returned holed up at home, making up for lost time. I looked past all the things that happened before and focused on the future. I wanted to believe him, so I did. And to me, there would be only one way to prove that this time around was for real. There would be only one way to show the world that after all the shit he talked about me, after all the abuse I took from him, he did in fact love me, and that I wasn't wrong for loving him. I wanted to prove I was lovable and worthy of the family I never had. I wanted the world to see me as I saw myself, the same as any woman. So for the next 3 months, I never let a day go by without reminding Aaron about his promise to marry me. I called chapels and gathered information and came up with the easiest way to make it all happen. I found out that in the city of Los Angeles, one could just walk into a local chapel and get married, the same as in Las Vegas, and for just over $300. Aaron and I already had rings, the matching diamond and sapphire ones I'd purchased the year before, and I chose a chapel just 20 minutes away. I bugged Aaron. I pressured him. I begged him until finally, on March 23rd, 2009, he gave in, and we were wed in a private walk-in ceremony. We wore jeans and t-shirts. Jonah, just less than 2 years old, was with us. My son spent his day in school unaware. It was all very last minute, and I hurried to get us to the chapel before Aaron changed his mind. He drove. I suppose I knew he didn't really want to marry me, and I knew I shouldn't be marrying him, much less dating or living with him, but I just needed it all to look perfect. Even if it was shit on the inside, the outside needed to seem ideal. We didn't tell anyone, no friends or family, knowing they would only disapprove, all for different reasons, none of them wrong. As the officiant pronounced us husband and wife, I grabbed Aaron's face with both hands as he held Jonah and kissed his lips through grateful tears. "Thank you," I said softly. His face was cold as he disconnected. The resentment was instant. Chapter 10, Things We Lost. "Are you happy?" I asked, grabbing Aaron's hand as it gripped the gear shift of my SUV. He was driving us back home, and as Jonah watched a movie in the back seat, Aaron stared at the road silently. "Are you happy?" I asked again. "You know what? I am. I'm very happy," he said, the same cold, disconnected look upon his face. I continued holding Aaron's hand all the way home, trying to lighten the mood, but he seemed to be sinking further into an abyss of contempt. By the time we pulled into my garage, he was angry, fuming. Soon after returning home, we began arguing. "Well, I hope you're happy now," he scoffed as he laid next to me in bed, changing channels on the television with the remote.
"You got what you wanted. This is what you wanted. Now you're going to have a sexless marriage like everyone else who's married, because I'm never touching you again."
I sobbed. "Why are you acting like this? You said you wanted to get married. Sure, I didn't want to wait, but you're the one who drove us down there. You're acting like I forced you."
"You did. And I hope you're proud of yourself. I hope you enjoy having a marriage like my mother and my father had. A miserable one, because that's what marriage is. Two miserable fucking people joined together by a piece of paper. It doesn't mean anything."
I continued to sob as my husband berated me, hopping out of bed and walking around to my side. Sitting there, my knees to my chest, my head buried in them, I cried, begging Aaron to stop, to lie back down and relax. But he continued to rant, to make clear his disdain for me, the sanctity of marriage, and our nuptials. I was his third wife, and he promised me on our wedding day, I would be his third divorce. Then, with hate in his eyes, my husband spit on me. He spit in my face, and so I spit back. With Jonah in the other room, he lunged for me, for my throat, and began to apply pressure with his forearm, the weight of his 215-pound frame applied to my neck. He was crazed as I gasped for air, as I kicked and clawed at his arm, digging my nails into his face, trying to get him off me, trying to survive another attack. I coughed and struggled, growing dizzy and close to unconsciousness. Then Aaron released me. Afraid for my life, I ran out of the bedroom, grabbed the car keys from the entranceway table, and fled into the garage. I locked myself inside my Mercedes sedan and called our church's pastor for help. This was my wedding day. Aaron hadn't kept most of his promises, but we did join a local church and found ourselves there most every Sunday for a while. We must have looked like a real family, walking in with our two children, praising and worshiping together. It must have looked so normal. But Aaron hated the church, and not just that church. He harbored a disdain for churches in general. He spoke of how his father was the musical director of one of the largest black churches in Los Angeles, and how Aaron gave so much of his money and time to that church. He spoke about the things he'd seen so-called saved souls do after church hours and all the hypocrisy that existed in organized religion. Aaron held so much disdain for so many things that he tended to make everything displeasing. He spoke often of the way his father cheated on his mother with women close to the family and many other random women, and how every Sunday his shattered family was all expected to show up at church and act as if nothing was wrong. Aaron had been acting all his life, on and off the stage, and now I was acting too. Our pastor came to the house on our wedding day to counsel us, as he had done before we were married. Usually, during these sessions, the things Aaron said and the way he saw the world were so terribly skewed that no one could have agreed with his logic. The pastor would side with me, and this would only infuriate Aaron. This time, our pastor managed to calm the situation, but the damage had already been done. In fact, the damage had been done 2 years before. I'd made a horrible mistake going back to Aaron, and I knew it. But I just couldn't quit. I couldn't give up on the idea of being fucking normal. So I stayed with Aaron, and the cycle continued. Soon, there was no one I could talk to about our relationship, not even the pastor. It made no sense to complain about something so horrible only to stay. So in June 2009, I began to keep a journal of the abuse instead. On June 25th, 2009, I wrote, "Aaron's financial contributions to our marriage have been sporadic, and when he does contribute, more often than not, it falls short of the mark. Aaron has not been living in the home for over a month. He came to visit me today at 2 p.m. and left at 2:50 p.m. To date, he has threatened to take half my money should we divorce this month, Just 90 days into the marriage, I suspect money is the reason he married me in the first place. Last week, he threatened to file for divorce. I told him to do so if he pleased. He has not. Now he acts as if the conversation never took place. Aaron often takes the baby from his bed in the middle of the night and at dawn, 9 p.m., 1 a.m., 4 a.m., to travel with him to music studios. On June 26, 2009, I wrote, Aaron has promised to be home tonight and has not shown, nor is he reachable by phone anymore. When questioned about his time frame for coming home, he replied, MJ is dead, bitch, referring to Michael Jackson. This response has prompted me to ask that he not return home until he is prepared to live a righteous life and be a husband according to God's word and rejoin our church, which he has neglected for 2 months. On July 2, 2009, I wrote, Aaron finally showed up this past Sunday, 2 hours late for church. He stayed until Monday afternoon. He was ill during that time with chest pains, heart murmurs, and extreme exhaustion. I nursed him both days. Today is Thursday, and he has not returned. He calls maybe once a day, but only after I have called him or texted repeatedly. He says he is now in Malibu. He has had his car towed to the shop and is depressed. He says he sleeps all day and night. As of 5:02 p.m., I have not heard from my husband at all today. I have called 4 times and sent 1 text message. I am not sure if he will be here for the 4th of July, as he promised. I feel completely abandoned and alone, uncared for and unappreciated. Neither our marriage nor I exist to him. On July 11th, 2009, I wrote, Aaron and I spent the 4th of July with the kids and his family. It was awesome. I was happy to be included. The kids had so much fun. Later that night, he and Jonah came home and stayed the night. They stayed the next day as well, and Aaron even left Jonah with Naeem and me for a portion of the day while he took meetings. Over the past week, he has shown massive improvements. 6 months and many, many physical altercations later, I prepared to move out of my home. It was August 2009, and the real estate bubble had burst. I bought my home in 2006 and maintained over $20,000 in bills and mortgage payments over the past 3 years with no help from Aaron during the times he lived with me, nor after we were married. He continued to live for free and use me, and I continued to let him. At the same time, one of my mortgage payments, which I assumed had been paid by my accountant, wasn't. That made it impossible for me to refinance my home when my arm fluctuated and my mortgage payments increased. When my mortgage company was bought out during the real estate crash, it made it impossible for me to modify my payment, an option set aside for those with trouble paying their bills. My mortgage jumped from $6,000 a month to $10,000, and it was just too much for me to bear alone. My entire life seemed to be in the hands of other people, and it was quickly being derailed. Aaron was rarely even home, and I struggled to pay the current mortgage and find a new home before putting my house up for sale, all the while taking care of him and his son as he continued to be primarily unemployed. I refrained from paying the mortgage in May and prepared to move into a newer, larger, less expensive home with the money I saved by not paying the bills at my current home. When the time came to pack up and move, Aaron was nowhere to be found. He was there with me when I found the home and toured it with me the day I handed over the check to the owners of the rental property. He contributed $1,500 to the $15,000 move-in cost. It wasn't much, but it seemed he was trying. Soon, though, he became frustrated with his financial shortcomings and his inability to help me do much of anything during this stressful time, so he picked a fight with me and left just before moving day. It was all very typical. So I handled the move all alone. The new home was significantly larger, boasting 3 stories and over 6,000 square feet. The home was built into a hillside, so each story was built down instead of up. The main entrance, common areas, and guest room on the top floor. the master and two other bedrooms downstairs on the second floor, and a complete studio apartment down on the third floor. It was the perfect size for Aaron, the kids, and me, with an entire third floor apartment that could serve as an office for me and a recording studio for Aaron. I was trying so hard to make it all work and to give Aaron reasons to come home and stay home more often. I bought more furniture to fill up my new temple, my homage to a life I didn't really have. I put new clothes in the closets. I set up a new room for Jonah with a brand new bed and dresser, toy box, and toys. It was all so perfect. Every room looked like the cover of a magazine. But four of the six bedrooms remained empty. Chapter 11. Soap Operas and Porn. About a month and a half after Naeem and I moved into the new home, Aaron and Jonah moved in too, though their version of moving in was more of an extended sleepover. Aaron soon developed a pattern of staying at home for a few weeks, then disappearing for two. I'd become so accustomed to this dysfunction and his misuse of me that I began looking forward to his return, being grateful even after reeling over each disappearance. His reasons for returning were always the same. He would spend weeks traveling and bouncing from one place to the next. He would live with his mother for weeks at a time until eventually she drove him away with her controlling influence. He would spend time with his sister, Samantha, and her husband and son, as well as his brother, Jonathan, his girlfriend, and their children. Naturally, there were long nights in recording studios and, I suspect, lots of other women. It was only when he got tired of living this way that he would come home to rest. With me, there was quiet and order. The kids were taken care of, food was cooked, laundry was done, everything was paid for, and the house ran on a very productive schedule. He craved that at the end of his trysts and vagabond adventures. I was nothing more than my husband's rest stop. Soon after his return, I helped Aaron prepare for an audition for a long-running soap opera on the CBS television network, which I'd been watching since I was 6 years old. I knew all about the character for whom he was auditioning and reprising. I worked with him for hours over a few days and gave him much-needed background information on the character and his relationship with the other characters in the soap. Aaron was well prepared when he left home for the audition, and I prayed he would get the job. I needed him to have steady work, and I know he needed it too. I thought that maybe he would feel better about himself if he was able to contribute in a significant way to the household. I thought that if he landed the series, he'd keep a better schedule and would be more apt to come home every day and participate in the home and the hope I'd been building for us. I was still hoping he would change. Still. Days after his audition, Aaron announced he'd be leaving town for a couple weeks. He never explained all the reasons why he was leaving or to where he'd be traveling, but I knew he planned on visiting his grandmother in Texas before returning to Los Angeles. He left town with the new manager he'd recently hired, a man with a sketchy background who promised him ridiculous things like a spot as the opening act for Michael Jackson's This Is It tour before the pop icon died. Aaron believed everything this man said, no matter how ridiculous and unfounded. This new manager told Aaron he'd be going on tour with all sorts of acts, like TLC, and he just figured it all must have been true. That's how deluded and distorted Aaron's view of the world and grip on reality was. That's how badly he wanted to be a musical act instead of an actor. This manager also told Aaron he'd be able to help him erect his own musical, which is what the two of them were doing during that trip, searching for venues, stage props, and whatnot. It was all so very confusing as I watched Aaron chase dreams and follow the guidance of strange men, men he would always call pops or uncle, as he always reeled from the father who had left him over 20 years before. Aaron was a confused and broken man with demons and secrets swirling around his head. And for the sake of family and the appearance of normalcy, I continued to force a relationship with him. 2 weeks turned into 3, and 3 weeks turned into 6, and I fought to stay in contact with my husband. He rarely answered the phone and never returned phone calls and text messages. I felt tortured as I waited to hear from him, pacing around my big, empty house. I'd fallen back into my normal self-destructive routine since Aaron came back into my life earlier that year. It was difficult for me to eat in times of stress, and I lost all the weight I gained when I was with Shad, hovering around only 100 pounds. My hair became thin and my nails brittle, and I drank red wine by the case. I resumed smoking cigarettes. I was back to taking Xanax to help me sleep and stay calm as I nervously waited to hear from my husband. All this distress showed clearly on my face and in my eyes. Then after not hearing from Aaron for weeks, he called. "Hello?" I answered.
"Hey,"
he said in his deep, burly voice.
"Listen, I want a divorce. This just isn't working for me. I mean, I didn't want to get married in the first place."
My heart sank as I listened to my husband say the same things he'd been saying since the day we got married. Part of me knew it was inevitable, and a part of me wanted it to never happen. If he wanted to file for divorce, there was nothing I could do. In Los Angeles County, there is no stopping a divorce unless the person filing changes his or her mind. And since Aaron and I shared nothing, there would be nothing to fight over. He could file, and within 6 months, our divorce would be final, no matter how I felt about it. After all he'd done and all I'd gone through, I should have been pleased to hear I was about to get another chance to save my life, but instead, I felt more broken than ever before. All I could say was, "Okay." I hung up the phone that day, not knowing when or if Aaron would return. I grieved for the next week, lying in bed with the curtains drawn, wishing I could go back to the summer of 2007 to Aaron and my first kiss. I wished I could undo it all. I wanted so badly to crawl out of my skin. It hurt to be me. I cried every day, all throughout the day, and drank myself to sleep every night. So many times over the past 2 years with Aaron, I thought about suicide and how easy it would be to deliver myself from the pain I was in. Then I would think about my son finding me and how the rest of his life would be ruined. I figured at least one of us deserved a chance to be happy, and I wanted to give that chance to him. But I couldn't do it in this condition. In November, about a week after Aaron announced he wanted a divorce, I opened up my laptop and clicked onto my Facebook page to find an article written by my old friend John Murray, reporting that Aaron had gotten the job as a series regular on the soap opera for which I helped him prepare. It was my first time hearing the news, and my mouth flew open as I connected the dots. My husband was going to divorce me now that he had a job, a 2-year contract with CBS. After everything I did, after all the money I spent on him and Jonah, he was leaving me now that it seemed he would be able to pay his own bills. It made perfect sense. "Why didn't you tell me you got the job?" I wrote in a text to Aaron.
"Because I couldn't tell anyone," he responded. "How did you find out?"
"The internet." "So now that you have a job, you want a divorce?"
"No, I've always wanted a divorce."
"But you couldn't file because you needed me to pay your bills and buy your clothes and take care of your son?"
"Fuck you, Corinne. See you in court."
But that's not exactly what happened. When Aaron returned to Los Angeles in the midst of the negotiation of his contract with the network, it turned out he wouldn't be making nearly as much as he expected during his first year on the show. And after agency and management fees, he would still be scraping the bottom. So in late November, he came back home, and I took care of him. The consistent money he was now making was more than he'd made during the entire course of our relationship. Aaron had worked sporadically while we were living together, and as soon as he got a check, it would be gone. He would give money to his mother, who was still a signee on his bank accounts as she had been since he was a child. He would take care of himself, his immediate family, and Jonah, but never me. The same applied when he began filming the soap in November. He filmed several times a week and was paid biweekly, Yet I never saw a dime, and I rarely saw him. As the holiday season came and went, my husband was absent, as usual. Naeem and I spent Thanksgiving alone, only to have Aaron come over 2 days later with a plate of leftover food from his mother's house. Leftovers. Mona owned him, and he would always be more her husband than he ever would be mine. He knew that I didn't have any family, that I alienated all my friends because of our abusive relationship, and that I'd be spending the holidays alone. He knew he was all I had, and he used that fact to continuously break me down and remind me how alone I was. Naturally, Aaron was also absent that Christmas and New Year. Still, I stayed put in that shrine of a home, worshiping a marriage that didn't exist, waiting for my husband to return. And he always did. In my journal, on November 24th, 2009, I wrote, "I have not seen my husband for 1 month and 1 day. He does not call regularly. He does not check on Naeem, ever. He is abusive, verbally and emotionally. He hangs up on me with no provocation. He says he wants a divorce, but wants to still be together and not tell anyone we're divorced. Aaron was doing so well for a while. He left on August 20th, 2009, until the end of September. He went to San Diego and Mexico for 2 days with no phone calls. I don't know where he lives. I don't know anything about him. I keep asking him to come home, but he won't. He refuses. I have lost 10 pounds. I am so stressed." On November 30th, 2009, I wrote, "Aaron came home around 1:45 a.m., November 29th, and brought Jonah with him. It was my first time seeing them in 5 weeks. Aaron was in good spirits, and I was happy to see both my boys. We talked and made love for the first time in 5 weeks. The next morning, we ate, fed the baby, and made love once more. We talked about our jobs and Jonah's custody situation. We remained in good spirits. The baby was clinging to me. He seemed to really miss Naeem and me and asked to stay with me. He cried when they left." On December 7th, 2009, I wrote, "Aaron and I spent most of the day with the kids. It was nice. He seemed very distracted and flustered with stuff in his life. He took Jonah and said he'd be back, but never came. He stood me up." On December 11th, 2009, I wrote, "Aaron went to a red carpet again, without me and without wearing his wedding ring. It is so embarrassing when journalists and friends call, asking why he never takes me anywhere and if he's ashamed. This is the fourth time he has done this, and it hurts. When I bring it to his attention, he says he doesn't care or understand what I'm talking about. He said, 'I have nothing to say about it,' and hung up. The emotional disregard is unbearable." On December 14th, 2009, I wrote, "Aaron promised to come by last night, but never made it. Again, he says he wants a divorce, but doesn't want to leave me. Yet he has not moved back home. Naeem is becoming affected by his absence and Aaron's attachment to Jonah only. We have not had sex in weeks, just once in 8 weeks. I asked him to not keep the relationship or me in limbo, to either reel me in or cut me loose, because this is too painful. He says he wants to be with me, he just doesn't know how. I said that actually being with me might be a good start. I gave him 24 hours to make his decision. He says he doesn't want to be married on paper. He says I forced this marriage on him, yet he is the one who drove us to the chapel that morning. I don't understand. I have been patient and I have allowed him to come and go as he pleases, but the non-commitment is becoming a strain. He has left me more than he has stayed. No help for food or bills at all, before or after the marriage. No regard for what marriage means. I married him for better or worse, for a lifetime. My life, my marriage, is not a game or a joke to me. I don't know if I can go on. He says his work is more important, and I'm not sure I can compete." On December 18th, 2009, I wrote, Aaron came by on the 13th and helped me season meat for dinner. He also took a few of his belongings he left behind 2 weeks prior when he spent the night. He came by on the 14th and went with me to the hardware store for ant killer and helped me lay it around the house before borrowing my Range Rover. He's had it ever since and has parked his car in the garage. It has some mechanical issues. I have asked him to stop by tonight for a date night. I'm trying to reconnect with my husband and save our marriage by showing him it is not the document that ruined our relationship. It was us and all the pressures of our lives that have changed us. I'm hoping that tonight will propel us to fall in love again. On December 31st, 2009, I wrote, Aaron promised to come home for Christmas Eve. He didn't, nor did he come home for Christmas, as promised. Now it's New Year's Eve. He promised he'd come. I guess I'll know soon enough. On January 1st, 2010, I wrote, Aaron never showed up last night. I brought the New Year in alone and in tears. He said he was at the emergency room with exhaustion and dehydration. He didn't even want me by his side. I don't even know where he lives. This is no marriage, and now I am begging him to stop threatening to file for divorce and just do it. It is obvious he doesn't care about me no matter what I've done to accommodate him. I have given him all the space and time he demanded, and he can't even spend holidays with me, nor does he lean on me during emergencies. We are not a team. This marriage is a joke, and all I want is to save it. But I can't do it alone. I am broken. On January 10th, 2010, I wrote, Aaron came by at 3:30 a.m. on the 6th. He came through the backyard and tapped on the bedroom's back door. He scared me. He said he was coming to drop off 2 shirts he bought Naeem for Christmas. Both shirts were way too small. He doesn't even know his own stepson's size. He asked to stay, and I let him. He asked to have sex with me, and I refused. He only uses me for sex. He misses holidays and birthdays, but shows up when he's horny. This is so unfair. I was not very warm toward him, given his treatment of this marriage and me. He has not spoken to me since. He ignores all my calls and text messages. I just want him to be a good friend, husband, and dad. He is neither, and I'm still broken, lonely, needing love. On January 16th, 2010, I wrote, Aaron came by on the evening of the 13th. He said he would no longer be using a cell phone. I knew he was lying, since he would need to contact Jonah in case of emergencies. I have no way to contact him except for emails, which he never answers. He helped me jump my car while he was here and went with me to fill up the tank before he took off. It was an hour-long visit at best. It's now been 3 days, and I haven't heard from him. Naeem's 12th birthday is in 3 days. I'm wondering if Aaron will remember or show up. In mid-January of 2010, Aaron came back to the house to celebrate Naeem's 12th birthday with us. Where he'd been and what he'd done while he was gone was, as always, a mystery. I never asked. There was so much I never knew about my husband, his whereabouts, his cohorts. He lied about everything all the time, and I believed everything he said every time he said it. And there were women, lots of them. So on February 1st, 2010, when Aaron left his email account open after using my computer, I couldn't resist. Though he'd spend as much as 7 months away from home at a time, and I'd come across inappropriate text messages between him and other women, he always insisted he was faithful. I suppose I always knew he was lying, but I still felt the need for more proof, so I went looking for it. It didn't take long for me to find more than what I was looking for, as I came across many inappropriate messages from a bevy of women and a particularly disturbing stream of emails between my husband and a nearly 300-pound pornographic performer who works under the name Felicia Fats. I felt physically sick as I began reading the emails between them and opening the bevy of lewd, pornographic photos and videos Felicia Fats had sent to my husband. I fell onto the floor as I read, disgusted by my husband's conduct and his flagrant disregard for our marriage and our children. My body began to shake and tears fell from my eyes as I fought back the urge to vomit. Their conversation, mixed with the graphic visuals, proved too much for my stomach. I couldn't go on. I'd seen enough. I ran to the bathroom, slumped over the toilet, and threw up. I hugged the cold white porcelain bowl as I sat, my legs shaking, banging against the travertine floors. Hot and acidic, the vomit tore through my throat like lava, consisting of nothing more than bile. I hadn't eaten in days, nearly a week. It had been a task to ingest even water. I'd done everything I could to be a good wife and mother. I'd supported my husband in every way I knew how. I cooked, I cleaned, I paid all the bills, and made sure he and the kids had everything they needed. I was always available to him, always home, always ready to receive him whenever he decided to come back to me. I changed everything I was for him and endured years of shaming and belittling by him and his family, to say nothing of the physical abuse, the beatings, the choking, the spitting. Now, there I was in this shrine I called our home, these three stories and 6,000 square feet of emptiness dedicated to the idea of the perfect family. There I was in the prison I built for myself on purpose, for the purpose of being finally loved and finally fucking normal. There I was, being anything but. Chapter 12. What has changed? My heart raced as I crawled back to the living room and to the phone to call my spiritual life coach and closest confidant, Deneen. She and I met through mutual friends back in 2001 while she was vacationing in Los Angeles from Birmingham, Alabama. From the moment we became acquainted, we were drawn to one another. She was almost old enough to be my mother and possessed very mothering qualities, though she had no children of her own. So I became her daughter. Deneen was very spiritually grounded, and no matter what my issue or circumstance, she always treated me with love and respect and was always teaching me about God. I was wild back then, and it took me over a decade to begin to fully understand everything Deneen had been teaching me, but she never gave up. She was always there for my good days as well as my bad, and there was no one else I could call to help me through what was happening now. I dialed her number hastily and paced as I waited for her to answer the phone, tears streaming down my face. Finally, she answered, "Hello, baby." She could barely understand a word I said as I rattled off all the details of what I found in Aaron's email. I told her about the disgusting pictures and videos and the upsetting set of emails between my husband and the obese porn star. I spoke quickly, choking on my words and drowning in my tears. "Calm down," she started. "Take a breath and listen to me. Now, let me ask you this. What has changed?" My sobs subsided, and for a few seconds, I couldn't breathe as I was overwhelmed by the question. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Look around and tell me what has changed since you read those emails. Have you lost anything? Or are you still in your home with your son and still in possession of all your achievements and all your graces? Look around. What have you lost?" Nothing, I whispered through my sniffles. "Right. And have you received any new information today?" "Yeah, I did." "Did you? Did you really find out something about Aaron you didn't already know?" I thought about that, and as simple as the question was, it was all so profound. "No, I knew all of this already. I mean, maybe I didn't know about this particular thing, but this is Aaron, always has been." "Okay," Deneen said with a sense of relief in her voice. "Nothing has changed. and there is no new information here, so why are you so worked up? Stay calm, call him, tell him to come home, and have a conversation with him about this rationally. It took everything inside me to do as instructed. My blood coursed and my body ran hot for the 2 hours it took for Aaron to return home after I insisted there was an emergency with my son, knowing the truth would only prevent him from coming. I stood by the bay window overlooking the driveway as his blue late model Jaguar pulled up to the curb. Still on the phone with Deneen, I rushed her off and assumed the proper positioning in my mind, calm and collected. I placed myself on the sofa, my laptop open to the emails, and waited for him to come through the door. I said a silent prayer, asking God for strength and patience. As he walked in, I sat there, somber.
"What's going on?" he asked. "Is the boy okay?"
"He's fine. Sit down. I have to talk to you about something." As he sat, I began to read from the string of emails between him and Felicia Fats. Tears streamed down my face and I heaved with the need to vomit again, still disgusted by the images of anal sex and self-fisting the super fat porn performer had sent him. I waited for my husband to shrink. I waited for him to be embarrassed after being found out, but no. Instead, he laughed at me. "You think this is funny?" I questioned as I grew angrier, trying to restrain myself when all I wanted to do was beat him to death with my Macintosh. Yet, I knew that if I showed any sign of anger, it would anger him too, and he'd hit me for sure. I remained calm and kept my voice quiet, not wanting to rile the giant.
"Yeah, it's funny," he replied, snidely with a huge grin, proud of himself and the hurt he'd inflicted.
"So you don't think this is an inappropriate conversation for a married man to have with another woman, much less a 300-pound sex worker?"
"Nah, I don't see anything inappropriate about it. It was just a joke. It's nothing."
"A joke? Nothing? You think talking to a woman about all the sex you want to have with her is a joke? You think hurting me is nothing?"
"Yep."
My husband laughed. I mean, really laughed as I sat there and wept, withering under the weight of yet another personal and marital defeat. All I could do was cry and keep crying. We sat there talking and debating until the sun went down and into the wee hours of the morning. I fumed and Aaron wallowed in my pain like a pig in slop. I went over all the horrible and hurtful things he did and said in the 3 years we'd been together that had torn me apart, diminished my esteem, and doomed our marriage and the future of our family. I pleaded for him to hear me, to please be the husband I deserved, to treat me better, to come home at night, and to help put our family back together. He laughed. Eventually, we both tired and walked down to the second story of the house into the master suite and crawled into bed. Somewhere along the way, I'm sure he promised to be a better man and husband. I'm sure he swore to never be unfaithful. I'm sure he said all the things that he thought I needed to hear so I'd just shut the fuck up and go to sleep. But as I lay there next to this man whom I both loved and hated, it all came rushing back to me and the tears returned. With my fists, I pounded on his thighs, screaming, "Why do you do this to me? Why?" Aaron sprang up from his resting position and pushed me off the bed and onto the floor. He darted to his jeans, which were flung over the bed's footboard, and drew his belt from its loops. As I lay on the floor crying, my husband stood over me and began beating me with his belt. I screamed and held my hands outward, trying to grasp the belt, to no avail.
"You want to act like a child?" he said. "Then I'm going to treat you like one," as he continued whipping me.
"Aaron, stop! Please, you're hurting me, stop!" I yelled out as he relentlessly continued striking me. The thick leather curled around my arms, back, and neck as it struck me, leaving burning, stinging welts on my skin.
"Is this what you want?"
he asked as he kept lashing.
You like this, huh?
He taunted as the blows became more powerful. Aaron continued beating me until we were interrupted by my son, who had awoken from his sleep and crept out of his bedroom in the midst of all the commotion and upon hearing his mother's cries. Just 12 years old, Naeem barged through the bedroom door, afraid but brave.
Is everything all right in there?
He asked, already knowing the answer. As I lay on the floor in a fetal position, my husband standing over me, belt in hand, I assured my son I was all right, even though both he and I knew it was a lie. Mommy's okay, baby. Go back to bed. As my son closed the door, being too young and too small to fight his 6'4" stepfather, Aaron grabbed my left arm and brought me to my feet.
Now take your ass to bed, he snarled.
I crawled into bed, sobbing and shaking, and curled into a familiar fetal position, my back turned to my husband. He flopped into bed and lay on his back for a few moments before rolling over and scooting his large frame directly behind me. I lay on my side as he pressed himself against my body, his rock-hard manhood pressing against my backside. He was turned on by the beating he'd administered, and there was nothing I could do against his advances. With Aaron, I was powerless, and no matter what he did, he was always allowed to use me, body and soul. He removed my panties, sliding them gently past my thighs and down to my ankles before parting my legs and easing himself inside. With my back turned to him, my husband had sex with me just as we had countless nights before, like a scratched and warped record. Two bodies so wrong for one another, but too familiar to disengage. I cried as my husband took even more from me, never satisfied, never having taken enough. When we awoke later that morning, we both acted as if nothing happened. I wanted it to be over.